This episode of The Urbanist was first broadcast on the 5th of March 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello, you're listening to The Urbanist on Monocle 24, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up in the programme, we light our way to a better city.
I decided to try to do a comparison between daytime and nighttime and see how legible a city could be at night under artificial lighting.
When we build towers, monuments or parks, we plan them for the daytime. And in most cities, not much thought or even afterthought is given to how they might live at night, how we illuminate or even enhance them. In this episode, we take a look at our cities at night, from gas lamps to high-tech LED.
But the story of kind of controlling light, changing the speed and animation of light, has always been part of our work, going back even a kind of, a few generations in technology.
Stay tuned. We'll start this episode speaking to Diana Del Negro, an architect who's now researching the impact of lighting on urban legibility and wayfinding. Diana has also been part of projects to relight many of Lisbon's monuments. She's published a book on the subject as well, focusing on the exterior lighting of heritage buildings and other sites. She joined me in the studio a little earlier.
During the day, a city is uniformly lit, more or less, although it changes during the day as the sun moves throughout the sky. But at nighttime, only certain things are lit, so only certain things are visible in a city. So things we take for granted as the hierarchies in a city of which buildings we use to find our way or which landmarks, which may not only be buildings but other urban elements, may not be visible anymore. So I decided to try to do a comparison between daytime and nighttime and see how legible a city could be at night under artificial lighting.
Now, I presume the obvious answer is less easy to find your way around with less light and with fewer buildings properly lit and less street lighting and less curbside lighting. It must become a more difficult way to navigate your way around at night. But what did your research find? Did you find that it was more complicated for people to find their way around, or that they just began to use different ways and different signs to guide them?
Well, I haven't completely finished my research, but it's almost over. The first results show that people are still able to find their way, although they follow different paths. So this means that lighting is guiding them differently, either because they're concerned about safety issues, so they feel that a street is not sufficiently lit, so they avoid that street, which may be the most direct way to go to their target location or to their destination. Or it may happen that the landmarks change completely. Something that was visible in the daylight no longer is. Something else is very well lit, so it becomes a new landmark and people are attracted by it.
I know this isn't the exact focus of your study, but if I was a city councillor or if I was running an administration and I began to look at your research, in the future, do you think it would help me plan how to use lighting to ensure that actually, if there is a very direct way between two places, you could use lighting to add security, lighting to add wayfinding, that would encourage people to use the same routes at night that they use in the day? Or do you feel that actually it's just important to understand that at nighttime and in daytime we have very different ways of mapping the city?
Well, it depends on the objectives. I think that it may be useful and it's possible to use lighting to make people go through a certain route. And that may be very interesting in some cases. For example, if you want crowds to move quickly in a certain direction, and if you have lighting cues that direct them that way, that the study suggests that that's possible. Well, sometimes it's not possible to control all the environment unless you have a very tight plan in which you say what can and cannot be lit in a city.
Yeah, tell me, I know that before you started this research, you were doing a lot of practical lighting in Lisbon.
Yes.
You helped come up with a plan for lighting public buildings and landmarks.
Yes.
Did the city take on that work because it was looking for, you know, beautification?
Yes.
Or did it also have a deeper understanding that this is part of how people would find their way around the city if you lit the buildings well?
Well, I think the main concern in most cities, I looked into over 20 lighting master plans all over the world, and the main concern is usually aesthetics. And aesthetics is usually related to economical aspects as to attract tourism. So the main thing about heritage lighting usually is to attract tourism. But it should be more important than that, because heritage lighting is a sum up of the identity of a people, of the people that live in a city, if you think about it, or even the country. You look at the main church and you think about the history that made that church be built. You look into the Eiffel Tower and you think about the world exhibitions and so forward. So people expect these buildings or constructions to be visible at night as well, and they're proud of them. And so it's rightful for them to expect this.
But going forward, you would like to see, you know, you've talked about lighting master plans, you would like to see a level of thinking that was about, sure, beautification, sure, about security, but that also acknowledge this more important element of actually how we work when we guide our way around a city by light.
Yes, because, you see, it's just recently that people have been thinking of lighting as an urbanistic tool, if you will. First, people started lighting just street lighting for people to be able to go safely on their way. And then they thought about lighting monuments because they were there and people expected them to see them lit. But there's so much more to it. As we were talking, it can aid wayfinding, it can help read a city better, it can help make a poor district more likable for its inhabitants. They feel prouder, they feel better. It can make an economical difference by attracting population to an area, by attracting tourism as well. It can have an impact on urbanism, as we were speaking. So it's so much more than just street lighting and monuments lighting.
That was Diana Del Negro there speaking to us in the studio. Lighting is an increasingly important part of how we think about public space, and rightfully so. Here in London, the winter months almost guarantee you'll be leaving the office long after the sun has set. But thankfully, some of the newer developments in the city are taking a much more considered, sophisticated approach to building spaces that look good at night. One of these is the redevelopment of King's Cross at the hands of developer Argent. Replete with interesting public spaces, they've also taken the step to extend their lighting scheme to indoor public spaces. A pedestrian tunnel leading to the London Underground is now home to a permanent light installation, a long wall of floor-to-ceiling LED screens that run the entire length of a long, curved wall. The latest designers to take control of bringing the space to life are London-based Spears & Major. The urbanist David Michon caught up with the firm's two principals, Mark Major and Keith Bradshaw.
When we first started or had the opportunity to work on the wall, we spent quite a lot of time kind of playing and testing about what the wall could do. But we really wanted to create something which was more than just a kind of a light wall. It was more an experience of space. So it runs this cycle of order and chaos as it changes from light to dark. That's a really important part of it.
And it also cycles through colours. And we're standing over a colour chart. So what's the kind of concept then behind the cycling of colours?
That's a good question. So as it were, the macro story, the big story of the piece is that we start in zero saturation in a kind of cycle, what is effectively white light. And then after a few weeks, the saturations will slowly increase. So after a couple of weeks, you'll begin to perceive more and more and more colour until finally, as we move further and further around the colour wheel, you'll see the piece in its kind of deepest saturations.
You know, I guess this is a tunnel that goes into the underground. Presumably people will be using this, you know, on a daily basis with their commute. So this is something that then they can experience a certain amount of change.
Yes, that's right. I mean, this is a very public space. And if you're a commuter using this tunnel, you know, every day, then your perception of the way in which space changes will be impacted as the piece breaks down into its half-life constituent parts. But the colour change will be imperceptible to you, say, on a daily basis. But if you are an occasional commuter, you come to King's Cross via this tunnel, say, 3 weeks after your first visit, you will notice a substantive difference in terms of the saturation and hue. So it's a piece that's all about time, and in a way has this sort of degree of subtlety of change, a sort of a slow process of evolution.
And I guess I'm curious kind of what mood you were trying to create, not only with the installation as it is when you would visit once, but just over time, kind of how do you think that experience, you know, will layer for people?
Well, I think different people will respond in different ways. What we found through our work is everybody's perception of this type of work will be quite different. I'm sure there'll be many that really, really like it, some that find it very surprising, even demanding. But I think the fact that the journey down the tunnel is very strongly related to the piece of work, it's a piece about movement. So depending on when you enter the tunnel and when you leave the tunnel and what state the piece is in, we kind of hope that actually the odd person stops, goes back, starts again, stands in the middle and actually engages with the work in a way in which they perhaps wouldn't normally in what if, at the end of the day, is a subway. I mean, a subway into an underground system.
Speaking about kind of these public spaces in general, do you feel like, you know, more of this should be used? I know obviously urban lighting is something that, you know, is starting to kind of take off, and the industry around it is really starting to galvanize. Will we see kind of less of this as a kind of, you know, a special piece of art and more kind of a regular feature of how we design public spaces?
Well, I mean, if you can imagine what a subway, how a subway would have been treated 10 years ago even. It would have been just very basic, bog-standard finishes, very basic lighting. And these were places that you needed to get through really quickly. They were kind of spaces of fast transit. In a sense, this is a move, I think, generally in terms of kind of public space, where there's a kind of generosity to this. But there's also, I think, a demand from a kind of consumer point of view to get the most out of all space, actually. So in a way, what's fun about this is that this is designed for people not necessarily stand still in, but enjoy on the move. So if you've just come off the subway system or you're rushing home or rushing to work, there's a moment in here of just kind of just joy. As I say, there's a kind of generous gift here in some ways.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of in a way part of a new generation of space, which is a generation of spaces that are curated, looked after, and because there's an understanding that people actually, the way they engage with space now, particularly in, you know, large cities like London, is there's almost an expectation that you will be looked after or provided with a special experience, treated in some special way. And I can't think of a better example in the underground system than, you know, coming out of the King's Cross tunnels, and, you know, you come into this and it's a fantastic gateway into King's Cross that reveals exactly that trend.
And I guess just a final question, simply about, you know, obviously as lighting designers, you are kind of keenly aware of the development in technology. And certainly if we looked at what lighting was able to do only maybe 5 years ago, certainly you wouldn't have these kind of really amazingly beautiful LED panels that could accomplish something like this. So how do you think this will kind of develop? I mean, where do we kind of sit in terms of the development of this technology?
That's an interesting question, because it's effectively, you know, does the technology in a sense lead the ideas, or do the ideas lead the technology? And actually, from the way we approach work, it's very much the ideas, you know, first, and then we try to find the right technology to do it. It's certainly true that the slickness of a piece like this and the digital programming of a piece like this is infinitely easier with an LED system than it would have been with the older technology, effectively. But the story of kind of controlling light, changing the speed and animation of light, has always been part of our work, going back even a kind of you know, a few generations in technology. So certainly the way we approach our work, it's the ideas first and the technology kind of follows on.
Great. Well, thank you both very much, unless you have some concluding thoughts.
Well, at the end of the day, this piece, as Keith said right at the outset, is about creating an experience for people. So we think and obviously believe or hope that this will, you know, provide people with a very interesting new take on this tunnel, one of a number of installations that will be taking place here over a period of time. And so, you know, we hope at the end of the day that what we've created, people enjoy.
That was Spears and Major Principals, Mark Major and Keith Bradshaw, speaking to the urbanist David Michon at King's Cross in London. Coming up, the French light show superstars and London's last remaining gas lamp engineers. Stay tuned.
From the streets of Kabul to a girls' school in the shadow of the Hindu Kush, London-based artist George Butler spent 3 weeks in Afghanistan, reporting on life in the war-torn country through that most old-fashioned of methods, paper and ink.
This is in Herat, and as always, I just picked a spot that I thought I could describe what I was witnessing as best as I could. It's very much that balance in Afghanistan of how long it's safe to be there, but also that drive to try and describe to people what it's like in a place that is almost always described as dangerous or unsafe.
Art of War, a Monocle film, now playing on monocle.com.
You're listening to The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck, and this is our episode on urban lighting. Today, as lighting technology takes leaps and bounds, we're seeing ever more elaborate projections on buildings, searchlights, water screens, and other kinds of illumination, which can entirely transform our urban landscape by night. And the French company Superbien is one of the world's leading outdoor projection specialists, having produced elaborate lighting displays for the Sydney Opera House, brands such as Dior and Google, and musical acts such as Japan's M-Flow. Monocle's Paris correspondent, Tom Burgess-Watson, went to meet the company's creative producer, Tom Scalabra, at their headquarters, which is appropriately situated in the heart of the City of Light. He started by asking him to explain more about what exactly Superbien does.
We use video as light, as material, as many things, and play with the video on any supports and on buildings, on structure, on sculptures, on many things, on screens. And the thing is that the core of our activity is telling story with motion, colors, and all this kind of stuff. As a producer, I kind of take a brief from a client or from an artist or from anything who wants to work with us, and then transform it into a story and try to find which graphic universe would suit the best the project. And then we have creative directors in the company that develop all these graphic materials, and then we have animators and all. Everyone has kind of a specialty, so it's we build up a team and then go for the project.
Could you give me some examples of some projects you've worked on that you're particularly proud of?
There's many, but there's, for example, one with, because we work with brands, but we also work with just some artistic projects. And for example, the Vivid Festival in Sydney called us to. They have the Vivid Festival is the light is a festival about lights in the city, and they asked us to cover the Opera House with video and with colors and all these things we do, and it was really. We were really proud to see the Opera House in Sydney, because it's a beautiful building and then it's quite famous. So it was big project for us.
You must be very proud of that, because I saw it's the front page of your website.
Yeah, it's one of our best projects.
Could you tell me a little bit about what sort of technology you're using? I mean, are you leaders in this field? I'm assuming you are.
We hope we are. we try to stay in the race and to be not pioneers, because all the technology we use it's kind of it's just lights and how it reacts. So many people explore this, but we now use as we come from video, we use video projectors and softwares that can match many video projectors together and create a big image and adapt this image on different surfaces. So it's called warping, and it's like just distortion of the image to fit the surface. But where we have like a little bit of advance is like we use a lot of generative images, which are basically it's either the sound or the movement or everything that can happen that creates image. We program things and we program a behavior in the computers, and if something happens, a reaction is already programmed and it creates an image. And if someone goes fast, for example, in front of a sensor, the image will be blue, and if it goes slow, it will be red, and all this kind of stuff, which is it's kind of innovative this time. A lot of people are thinking on these fields, and we try to keep up the pace on this matters.
Can you think of any really mad projects you've been asked to work on, really truly extraordinary or weird? Any particular anecdotes from your recent memory?
We were asked a few months ago to create a rainbow over a whole city. Of course, that's not doable, but the demand was really, really funny, and you can see how what people want is like they want to create things that are impossible, and the fact that they asked us is that maybe they think that we can do miracles, or I don't know. So yeah, we're on the right path.
That was Monocle's Tom Burgess Watson reporting from Paris. Now we move on to something that goes rather unnoticed. Around 1,500 gas lamps that are still left in the streets of London. They give you a glimpse of what the city might have looked like in Victorian times. And there's a team at British Gas that's exclusively dedicated to ensuring they're all very well maintained. Ian Bell is an operations manager at British Gas, and he oversees the lamp lighting team that deals with these lamps. He spoke to Monocle's Alice Block earlier, and they started by chatting about the history of London's gas lamps.
The lamps we're talking about are gas lamps that we look after, and British Gas looks after 1,300 gas lamps out of about 1,500 lamps that are currently in London.
And how old are these lamps? How far do they date back?
Well, the first lamps got put in around about the end of December 1814, so you're looking now at 200 years old. The oldest lamps we've got are when George IV was in reign in Britain. So, yeah, you're looking at 200 years old, the oldest ones.
And whereabouts are these lamps? Are they kind of placed in, you know, quaint London streets, or are there any particularly surprising locations where we might find one?
You've got a bit of both, to be honest with you. You've got them on all over Westminster, so Covent Garden's full of gas lamps down there. You've obviously got the public Royal Park, so you've got Hyde Park's got gas lamps in it. You've got St James's Park, it's full of gas lamps, Green Park. And then some of the historical buildings, obviously the most notable one will be Buckingham Palace. It's all around the front of Buckingham Palace is gas lamps. And equally, in some of the quaint little alleyways, you'll find gas lamps mounted on the walls all throughout Westminster.
It does sound like quite a lot of lamps. I mean, how many people do you have to manage them, to light them? What's your team?
We've got a team of four British Gas lamp attendants who do the maintenance of the lamps, which is pretty much the cleaning of them and making sure that they're in light and they go out of light at the right times. And then we've got a specialist, Gary Usher. He's our senior engineer, and he does all the repairs, which might sound quite straightforward, but they're anything but. He has to, you know, when they get damaged, he has to rebuild the lamp, he has to reglaze the lamp. So it's a bit of everything, really, that Gary does. So he's the senior engineer.
And has a lot of work gone into preserving these lamps, making sure that they still exist in these locations? I'm guessing it's something a lot of people are very fond of, this kind of softer light that maybe reminds people of, I don't know, nicer times, maybe induces a bit of nostalgia.
Absolutely, yeah. There, a lot of the lamps you'll find are protected by the English Heritage. So if the lamp gets damaged, first and foremost, we have to do everything we can to repair it. If it's beyond repair, an exact replica has to get put back, even to do a replica of, as I said, the George IV emblem. So a lot of the columns you'll see around London, they'll have the reigning monarch's emblem on it, and every bit of that detail has to get put back on if it gets damaged, unfortunately.
And just finally, Ian, what about the future? I mean, do you think these lamps are here to stay? Is their future secure?
Absolutely. As I said, English Heritage protects a lot of the lamps. So the 1,500 lamps that are in London, that number will never go down. It'll only ever go up. And even now, when new buildings are getting done, you know, we get the architects, so I'll look to put gas lamps in. Just as you mentioned earlier about that soft yellow light, it's a calming light that the public want, the architects like it. And, you know, we put four lamps were added into the Queen Mother's Memorial down on the Mall. So we're adding more lamps in, so the numbers are growing, believe it or not.
That was Ian Bell, Operations Manager at British Gas, speaking to Monocle's Alice Block. Well, that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. Remember that you can find out more about all of our shows at monocle.com or on our very own Monocle 24 app. And join us next week as we look at cities and hospitality. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Rabello and David Michon and edited by Holly Fisher and Alex Funnell. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's The Black Keys with Everlasting Light. Thank you for listening, city lovers.